Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions that you have left for me either in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. Things are really exciting in the world of Chris Shelton, Critical Thinker, these days. With my book now published, it's been out for about 2 weeks now. I think sales are going pretty well. I don't really have anything to compare it to, but for me, I'm pretty happy so far. But I'm always wanting to get the word out to lots more people. And on that note, I have been doing a lot of promotional work. I have some radio spots booked this next week. I've been on Hemet Mata, the Friendly Atheist. I recorded a podcast with him that should be coming out soon. And I'll have other podcasts and activities happening on this. And in fact, one thing I wanted to tell everybody about is on Monday, January 11th, from 6 to 10 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, which is Denver time, which is where I live, I will be on Reddit doing an AMA, an Ask Me Anything. And so for that four-hour stretch there, I will be at my computer right here answering questions about myself and anything anybody wants to ask me about that I can give answers to. So check it out. That will be on the Scientology subreddit. I think it's /r/Scientology. You can find it pretty easily, and that'll be happening Monday night. So without further ado, let's get to your questions. Linda Clement. Hi, Chris. I have never found the word love in anything I have read or watched about Scientology, except in personal stories of disconnection. It's clear by its behavior that the church doesn't value love, and as both Hubbard and Miscavige showed, all the symptoms of antisocial personality disorder, neither of them ever felt love. Does Scientology ever mention love at all? Well, actually, love is defined and talked about in a little section of Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, which was published, of course, in 1950. So right from the get-go, Hubbard did talk about love. And in that book, he talks about the difference between what he called a reactive mind kind of love, which was sort of this, you know, idea that you that your mate or your partner is a pseudo substitute for your father or your mother or who, you know, some person out of your reactive mind, out of your, you know, emotional trauma from the past, and you're just taking that and putting it into somebody now that's in your environment, and that is this sort of, you know, crazy kind of love, right? And he differentiates that from true love, or, you know, this, what he called, I think, admiration. He used admiration and affinity, or wanting to be close to something, an intensity of affinity or an intensity of admiration was how he defined love there and in other places. He also gave a whole lecture on the subject of, in Scientology, what they call the second dynamic, which is that sphere of life or activity that deals with sex and love and family and parenting and having kids, and all of that activity is sort of bundled into this concept in Scientology called the second dynamic. And so there's actually quite a bit of attention paid to it in Scientology. Not particularly a source of a lot of criticism particularly or anything like that, so it doesn't come up a lot in videos, you know, or things I've spoken about, and it's not really commented on too much. I'd actually like to comment on one thing about this, though, which is I talk about in my book what happened to me and how I lost my fiancé, you know, a woman I was going to marry, who disconnected from me. And that was a rather harsh experience, and it made me realize after coming out of Scientology that all the years that I'd been in, I'd bought into a conditional love. The idea of conditional love or conditional friendship, and thinking that that was a totality or a satisfactory kind of love, right? In other words, what I mean by that is that when you're in a destructive cult, and specifically Scientology, but I believe that this applies to all destructive cults, you are friends or you have love or affinity or affection for other people to the degree that they agree with and are part of your destructive cult. I think that the word friend in Scientology is defined as a fellow cult member. And if you are no longer, if you become friends through the cult, and then the person leaves the cult or doesn't want to be part of the cult anymore, then that friendship is severed because that person is no longer a fellow cult member. And this definitely applies as well to relationships. Certainly did in my case, and I've seen it and witnessed it with many others, where once a person is no longer a Scientologist or doesn't want to be or becomes disaffected with Scientology or is thinking something wrong with this, that friendship or that love declines. It can get cut off. And it's not always by the order of an ethics officer. It's a mental thing that people in these groups do. And I think it's a result of the black and white thinking, the whole us versus them sort of thinking that gets, you know, inculcated and indoctrinated into Scientologists, right? Where it's like you're either with us or you're against us, right? And I think that has a lot to do with their idea of love and who they're willing to be affectionate with or be friends with and that sort of thing. And I find that very unhealthy. I don't think that's a good way to, I don't think conditional friendships or conditional love is a very good, healthy way to feel emotion, and feel that kind of emotion. I will only love you so long as you agree with me sort of thing is like kind of, I mean, sure, you have to, in order to have a relationship with somebody, you certainly have to agree on some things. And, it's understandable if there are such massive disagreements that a relationship just isn't possible because there's nothing for you to talk about or get along with. I'm really not talking about that. I'm talking about this thing where there's this, it's a conditional thing. So anyway, I think that's a comment that's needs to be made about emotions and affection, specifically with destructive cult members like Scientologists. A non-lover. Hi, Chris. Loving the new book. Your output just keeps getting better and better. My question is about word clearing in Scientology. I've heard many former members describe word clearing for misunderstood words in ways that almost sound like obsessive compulsive behavior. And I noticed many ex-members still seem to obsess over getting the right definition and splitting hairs over which definition to use, even after they have been long gone from the fold. Was word clearing and constant dictionary lookups a habit you had to break when you first got out? Or was leaving that behavior behind easy to shake off? This is a really good question because I talked about this, I think, a week or two ago about study in Scientology. And I was a course supervisor in Scientology, meaning I was a teacher, or I had that role of the teacher type role where I was the person overseeing classrooms of students. And so I, word clearing, the idea in Scientology that you can't truly understand something if you don't understand the definitions of all the words that are used in a text or in a lecture, that's what word clearing is. And if you find a word you don't fully understand or there's some part of it you don't understand, you're expected to use a dictionary and look it up and use the word in sentences until it kind of clicks for you and then go back to studying. Hubbard makes a big deal about this. And I do think it's valid in study that's the case. I think it is important to understand the words in order to understand the tune that those words are speaking. However, and a really big however, because this was a big part of my recovery, Scientologists take this to definitely an obsessive compulsive level. And I don't think that's necessary, right? I had to kind of practice a little bit at not obsessively having to have a dictionary by my side while I was reading things after I got out of Scientology and discovered that, you can actually understand things from the context of the words around things, that actually is valid. There's not, in Scientology, it's like, no, you can't do that. And actually, if you can pick up the meaning of something, great, pick it up and run with it, As a critical thinker, I do feel it's important to have a dictionary around because sometimes you can quibble on things or you can slightly misunderstand what somebody is saying, and it's good to be able to clear that up. But I don't find myself obsessing over it anymore, and I think that it is a holdover from the Scientology indoctrination that people get a little bit too about the splitting hairs over words. You know, you have a meaning, you have a concept, you're trying to get that concept across to somebody, and however you do that is valid to me, you know, and if that means, you know, using some different words or explaining yourself or whatever, fine, right? As long as the concept is getting across to somebody, that's all I care about now in my own study and in my own communication. And I feel like if I've done that or accomplished that in some way, then I've had a successful communication. So that's kind of how I look at that now. And I don't know that I have a lot of judgment about this particularly, because I know also that in education, different people understand things different ways. Like people's brains work kind of differently from one to another. So maybe for some people, you know, being a little bit picky about words and whatnot is necessary for them and for how they understand the world. But I personally, I kind of gave that up and I don't have a lot of attention on that anymore. Paul Stetler. Chris, I have to ask this, and I would really appreciate it if you addressed this question in a video. What attracted me most about Scientology is the ability of creating perception. It's a perception that does not reflect reality at all. It's a thought that I've always had nagging at me since childhood. What I mean by this is life as we know it regarding religions, countries, civilizations, etc., past and present, can all be a lie. It may not, but at the same time it may be. I think you will understand what I'm getting at here. Please use your critical thinking to expand upon this and address. I thank you kindly. The study of perceptions and how we know things and what things we know and that sort of thing, I believe all of that falls under a subject called epistemology, or the study of knowledge. And that's a big subject, and it's a big pool to dive into. And I've sort of put my toe in the pool of that a little bit over the last 2 years, kind of looking at philosophy and the philosophy of science and how science determines whether it knows or doesn't know something. There's a guy named Karl Popper who was a modern science philosopher, and he had some very interesting insights into scientific method and how we go about knowing things or learning things or discovering things. And of course, there's a lot of psychological studies about this, and we talk about it in terms of confirmation bias and the cognitive dissonance and these words we use that come out of psychological studies to talk about how we perceive things or how we decide to know or judge things, right? So there's this huge field to it. I'm only skimming the surface when I'm using words like that or talking about it in those terms. And you can really dive in because, you know, how do you trust your perceptions, right? It's an interesting thing. We have our senses, and that is how we experience the world and the physical universe around us, is through sight and sound and hearing. But there's a lot of things that can be perceived that we cannot perceive through our senses. Infrared, for example, or ultraviolet light rays, right? We can't see those things, not without instrumentation. And then we get the instrumentation and we tune it in and we see these things, and suddenly we're seeing things we never saw before. They were always there. They always existed, but we just couldn't see them, right? And the same applies with hearing and, you know, almost any other sense. And it sort of opens the door to making you wonder whether you're really experiencing the full gamut of reality or not through our senses, right? That are we really getting the whole picture? Maybe 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, some new instrument will be developed that will give us a whole different perception that we can't even conceive of right now, that could change our entire view of cosmology and evolution and science and all of that. Who knows, right? So I like to keep myself open to those ideas. I like to keep an open mind when it comes to thinking about that sort of thing. And I find in the world of critical thinking that there are people who call themselves critical thinkers who don't keep an open mind. And this is why I've made videos or statements about the fact that, you know, I don't know are the three most important words in critical thinking. And I believe in science and reason as well, right? Because it's the I don't know that draws us and carries us into learning new things. If you think you know everything already, you're not really willing to look or discover new things, and you're not open to receiving new ideas. And I think we should always be open to receiving new ideas and thinking in ways that are outside the box, you know, and that sort of thing, right? I believe that's what critical thinking is really all about. And it's, you know, and there's various opinions about this, you know. I mean, conspiracy theorists think that critical thinking means you're always challenging authority and you can never trust anybody and this sort of thing. That's sort of what I get from them, is I'm a critical thinker because they don't accept the party line, right? Well, sometimes the party line aligns with the evidence to hand, right? But at the same time, there's always new information to look at and always new things to see. So when it came to Scientology, and I know where your question came from with this, there's this whole idea of man as a spiritual being, that we exist on a spiritual level that transcends everything that we see and sense and experience with our bodies. And that is sort of like opens the door to all kinds of possibilities, past, present, and future, right? Where we've been and where we're going could conceivably be almost anything. And this is one way, when people start thinking this way, that they're able to imagine past life incidents that are, you know, really far out, one, you know, amazing things, magic and intergalactic civilizations and all kinds of crazy things that people can imagine. They let their imagination run away with them because it gives them the idea that anything is possible. I like to limit my possibilities a little bit, you know, into the realm of reality, right? And I think that when it comes to how we perceive things or how we decide on the truth of something, we only have our senses to go by, so let's just kind of take it and take what's there in front of us and kind of run with it. And let's kind of skip a lot of the, you know, deep philosophical epistemology arguments about, well, you know, are we really seeing what we're seeing? Maybe this is all a dream, you know, all these kind of non-falsifiable ideas that you can't ever prove or disprove. And so they're sort of fanciful ideas, but they don't really get us anywhere. And so I like to try to ground my thinking in reality. And that's where my critical thinking tends to take me in the direction I tend to go. Otherwise, I feel I'm going from critical thinking into philosophy and religious concepts and things like that. And I'm open to those things, but I don't think that should rule our life or be a substitute for the four walls around us and the reality of the world that we live in. So that's probably about the most philosophic tirade I've ever gone on. So I hope all that made sense. And really what all I'm saying is, hey, let's just keep it real. Jesus Christ. Is the mess better in Clearwater or Hemet? Please elaborate on the menu that is provided for staff. Since there is clearly no money in a staff member's budget for groceries, are they hostages of nutrition at all? I have seen reed-thin Scientologists with black rings around their eyes. Also in videos, I have seen some paunchy, disheveled, fat bastards too. Well, I only ate at Clearwater one time for like a few days when I was there, and I never went to Hemet and ate the food there. So I can't really speak intelligently about the food in those places, but I will talk about the food that I ate in PAC, at the PAC base in Los Angeles, because I was there for, you know, many, many years. And I was never really happy with the food there. Now, I happen to know the people who, you know, were really working their guts out to try to provide a decent meal for all of us on the base. One person who was the lead steward or the chief, you know, the chief galley steward during a lot of the time that I was there in PAC is now out of the Sea Org. She's an ex-Scientologist now. And so I'm not going to sit here and badmouth her or her efforts, because she really worked hard to try to put meal planning together, or menu planning, and use the money that she had, which was sparse, to, you know, give healthy meals to the crew, right? We had a little salad bar, and we had a fairly regular routine menu of dishes that was sort of circulate around like once every 2 or 3 weeks, right? So we had meatloaf, and we had lasagna, and we had spaghetti, and we had every Tuesday at lunch was Burger Tuesday. Oh my God, everybody looked forward to that because it was burgers and fries. And so other than special occasions like the 4th of July or, you know, something like that, you wouldn't get burgers. But, you know, on Burger Tuesday, everybody got burgers, right? So there were big lines. Everybody would line up and make sure they were there for that, right? And you hoped you didn't get there too late and the fries were cold and that sort of thing. But other times, you know, there was some really nasty stuff served. I mean, I hated the curry, never really got into the salad bar. And unfortunately, breakfast almost every single day for all those years I was in were runny eggs. And that was really not fun. On Sunday mornings, when the galley had more time to actually cook up some food, we would have pancakes and maybe some strawberries and some fruit and whatnot. And an effort was made. I mean, it really was. But the problem, the main problem with the messing system and the way that the menu was done in the Sea Org is just so little money was allocated for it. And the crew welfare is really of almost no importance to anybody in the Sea Org. The crew don't care. They don't, you know, believe that they're worthy. This is how sick it gets, is the crew don't really believe they're worthy of a higher standard. And the executives don't have the money to provide a higher standard because of the whole finance system and the way the money flows and works in the Sea Org. Almost all the money that's produced by the Sea Org members goes up the line. And when money goes up in Scientology, meaning up to INT management and international reserves and Sea Org reserves and these big bank accounts, it doesn't come back down. Ever. So it's kind of this vacuum sort of tube that just sucks things up the line. And the crew are just given the dribs and drabs. And they think, because of the way they're talked to and the way the culture of the Sea Org works, that that's all they deserve. Because they're not working hard enough. Because they're not on purpose enough. Because they're not getting their job done well enough, right? Because at the end of the night, as Tom Cruise said, you know, at the end of the night, when their head hit the pillow, they feel like they didn't do everything that they could have done that day. And so the motivational speak affects them and affects their morale, and it makes them feel like they're not, you know, that they shouldn't have good things. And so when they are, from time to time, when some Sea Org executive, and there have been a couple, took efforts to invest money in the crew, everybody was just wide-eyed, like, what? You know, there was a guy one time at a continental level, he managed the money. He was an Italian guy, he used to be a restaurant owner, and he was in the Sea Org in Los Angeles, and he did a whole renovation of the main mess, like retiled it, got new tables made. I mean, it was a big deal, and it really changed the whole character of the place that we would go to eat our food every day, and he wanted higher standards for the crew. He, as an individual, had to work the money to make that happen, and he was in a position to do so. Very rare in the Sea Org that those two things come together. One, somebody who can work the money, and two, somebody who's willing to actually invest in the crew. They talk about investing in the crew, but they never do. And it's very sad. It's a very sad state of affairs for them. And it's reflected in the quality of the food. It's reflected in their uniforms. My wife, when I was in the Sea Org, had two shirts for about 2 years. She never got another shirt. You know, it was like you had to practically beg to get new pants or new shirt or something like that, right? And of course, you know, you're given this pittance of pay. So, you know, in terms of, you know, you mentioned going out and getting groceries. Well, I'll tell you, when I was in the Sea Org on Sunday morning when we had our cleaning time, I would go to a local grocery store, and I wouldn't just buy socks and underwear for myself, because you had to buy that for yourself. I'd buy some snacks with some of the money that I had. You know, I'd invest most of my money in stuff that I could eat during the week. I'd buy some canned food. I got SpaghettiOs or chili or something like that in cans. And I got some snacks that I could have at night when I went home, so that I would have something to supplement my diet, because the food that they serve you just didn't do it. And that's how you end up with Sea Org members looking so gaunt and so thin, or some people's bodies react reversely and they get bigger. And I don't know how all that works, but But I certainly observed it, you know, happening, but they're just as unhealthy. Those big fat people with the guts, I mean, they're not eating well. That's not a result of them being gluttonous, you know, that's because nobody in the Sea Org gets that opportunity. So that was kind of my experience with that. And it's kind of a grim picture that I'm painting because it is grim. It's the life of a Sea Org member, and it's not fun, and it's not, and that was at my level. I don't know what things were like at Flag, or although I heard they were very similar, and at Hemet, you know, I don't know. I heard it was even worse up there because they have this whole system with little cards or something, and they would get this card system where they were given tickets or something, and that was how they got food, and that's how they got their laundry done and stuff like that. And if you didn't get these cards, then you didn't get food, and you didn't get paid, and you didn't get your laundry done. And I mean, Jesus, you know, that would, ugh. So, you know, not really a lot of fun. And that was my reality. And that's also, one last note. That was one of the main reasons I really enjoyed being sent out on missions, and why the last 4 years of my Sea Org experience being out on the road all the time, you know, I missed a lot of things that from the base. I missed being around my wife. I missed getting on study or doing my, you know, my enhancement time. But I'll tell you one thing I didn't miss was the food. You know, I got to eat out, and we didn't get a lot. I had $20 a day for food. That was it. So it wasn't like I was eating like a king when I was out, because I wasn't. But I was eating better food than if I'd been on base. So that's sort of the food experience in the Sea Org. It's flash answer time. Eck Dubell. Hi, Chris. Quick flash question. I'm currently reading your book, Cheers, and at your suggestion in Chapter 5, I referenced the 1959 HCO Manual of Justice. While I was familiar with Hubbard's use of the term squirrels, I had never run across the term wildcat. He describes the proper handling of both wildcat people and wildcat magazines. Based on the context, I can only assume it's a derogatory term, but can you please clarify? I certainly wouldn't want to have a misunderstood word, haha. Thanks as always, and congratulations on what is so far a really great and informative book. Wildcat actually is the same as squirrel. It's same. I think he came up with wildcat first as some sort of like, you know, an offshoot or somebody being kind of a wildcat, kind of being out there and doing their own thing and not paying attention to the rules or regulations that Hubbard was laying down. And then that somehow along the line, he changed that to squirrel. I think he thought he was being clever with squirrel, because a squirrel, he called, you know, a person who's just running endlessly in a hamster wheel and looking for a nut, you know, and this kind of thing. So squirrel became the preferred derogatory term for people who were doing their own thing with Hubbard's works. Jennifer Isaacs, can you please tell me if Scientology ever talks about philosophy and philosophers? What do Scientologists think about free will, subjectivity, and things like that? Thanks always for all your time in answering so many questions. Yeah, no problem. I love answering all these questions. And the truth is that Scientologists don't think about philosophy. Hubbard quoted from and talked about philosophers in his early works, and even thanked some of them, and put them in the credits, or, you know, the attributions in some of his books, like Science of Survival, I think. But after that beginning period, Hubbard came more and more to think that he was the single source of all of Dianetics and Scientology, and he started bad-mouthing earlier philosophers and earlier people who had worked in the area of the mind or the spirit. So then Scientologists, of course, because they listened to Hubbard bad-mouthing these guys and saying how they really didn't understand things or really couldn't figure things out, Scientologists then devalue philosophers and philosophy, and Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and the Greek traditions and all of the things that come from that, leading all the way up to modern critical thinking, are just totally poo-pooed by Scientology. They don't care about any of it, they don't think any of it is important, and they don't study or read it in a general, you know, as a body. You might have exceptions here and there, or people who were trained in it, but for the most part, Scientologists could care less. Don Winslow, I'm curious about the immeasurable amount of acronyms in Scientology. Do you think their purpose is to add to the concept of Scientology being, as what L. Ron Hubbard would say, a mystery sandwich? On that note, as a former member of the Sea Org, have you witnessed any members advancing to the OT levels? Okay, Don, you're twofer here. One, I think that the acronyms are just another part of the control system of Scientology, and that it's got its own little language. And so not only do you have all the words of Scientology, but then you have the acronyms of Scientology, because Scientologists are into talking really fast and da 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 da. And so they shorten these things down and use these acronyms. But it's just another part of the language being used as a control system. And as far as people making it up to the OT levels in the Sea Org, not unless they paid for it. Or rarely did I see senior executives moved up to the OT levels. And I'm talking about like this many. So not very often. Riggs BF. I was wondering if it's well known that Scientology forbids medicine. My question is, does that include vaccines? Okay, well, Scientology doesn't particularly forbid medicine, and I think I talked about this in an earlier Q&A, so you can check that out, as to what they do and don't think about medicine. There are definitely Scientologists who are anti-vaxxers. I've seen that. But Scientology does not have any blanket policy that forbids or gets in the way of anybody using vaccines. So I think that's a new thing. Thank you, Jenny McCarthy. Leo Taxel. Hi, Chris. I have a question about the Sea Org and private property. If someone owns a house and a car before they join, do they have to sell that or give it to the church? Yeah, they have to sell it. They can't have a house and come into the Sea Org, and most of the time they end up selling their cars too, but not all the time. You can own a car as a Sea Org member, but you certainly can't own any property external to the Sea Org when you're in it, at least not as a normal course of affairs. Maybe people inherit it and stuff like that, and they'll sell it off or something like that, but it's pretty rare that a Sea Org member is going to own any property anywhere else. Chris Wood. In your last Q&A video, you described some of the pressure to get results that is placed on the local orgs, and that consequences are at times severe for not cutting the mustard. This open-ended scenario seems to me to be the perfect breeding ground for falsifying numbers and bogus reports being produced by the local orgs on a wholesale basis. In your experience, did you see or know of any trumped up numbers, falsified documents, obfuscation, and such like being conducted at the local levels of Scientology? How about at mid-level management? All the time. False statistics were something we dealt with on an almost weekly basis from some org or another, or some area or another, or some, you know, guy or another, right? This came up all the time. The pressure for the production, the demand to get the numbers, regardless of what was really happening in the real world, definitely, obviously creates this, you know, people making stuff up because they didn't feel like they had any other choice. And this was just routine, just commonplace. Okay, and so we've come to the end of another episode of Critical Q&A. So if you have any questions or comments for me, and I'm getting tons of them, way more than I can keep up with, guys, just so you know. So I'm doing my best to select out the best ones or what I think would be some of the most interesting ones, but keep them all coming. And, you know, I do keep them all. I've got a big file of all of these things going all the way back to the beginning. And I go through and, you know, select them out as best I can, but it's just gotten impossible at this point that I'm going to answer every single question that comes at me. But, you know, keep them coming at me, because some people ask some of the most interesting things. And of course, that also includes anything not having to do with Scientology too. You can ask me about anything you want. So again, I'll remind everybody about my AMA on Reddit happening on January 11th. That'll be from 6 to 10 p.m. On Mountain Standard Time, which is my time, Denver time. And you can ask me anything there too. So until next week, I'll see you guys later. And don't forget to buy my book.